Welcome to Cattle HQ, a podcast from industry experts and progressive producers discussing cutting-edge info about the cow-calf sector to keep cattlemen and women in the know and positively affect their bottom line.
Welcome back to Cattle HQ. I am Madison Cavarna, a beef nutrition field specialist with SDSU Extension. In the last episode, I talked with Wayne Vincent from Common Sense Solar and my coworker Pete Bauman, a wildlife and natural resources field specialist. As promised, this episode contains the second half of the conversation that we had regarding alternative water sources. I hope you will enjoy the second episode, and we will jump right in.
Let's talk about systems management, and let's start with the pond. Let's start with, like, okay, I got cattle on a dam. I want to just do the first best right thing, get the cattle out of the dam. Right now, the progression of pumps, you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier. There's a lot of, you know, we've had some pumps we played with early on 10, 15 years ago that, you know, did the job in the time, but they've advanced. But let's talk about the why. Okay, so Wayne, when you're setting up a system on a pond, and I'm going to let you I think I know the answer, but okay, where do we want to pull water from in that pond? Let's start with that. Is shallow versus deep, which is better? And where in the water column do we want to try to pull our water from if we want to actually maximize our very best water quality?
I always like to get middle to lower. It's going to be cooler water. You're going to be out of the algae belt most times. But I'm going to jump in here real quick, Pete.
Yeah.
I don't think I've even talked to you about this yet, but when we started this out, we were so crude with some of the systems we had. They were like a floating bilge pump, and they pumped a ton of water. Mm-hmm. Remember those mm-hmm. ones?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then we ended up getting into this, putting some wearables in this water, because it gave us more control. We had a control, we had a float switch, and we could actually pump more water that way. The issue that we saw, that myself and others in my field saw, was that suspended solids, the tolerances on these submersible pumps, they're meant to be in a well casing. That's the water they're meant to pump.
Right.
Clean water, right? Clean and green. So, because there would be a few instances here and there where you just start to see some excessive wear on the pump just because of the solids going through or the mineral going through it. So, talking with a certain manufacturer that I do a lot of, most of my development with, they developed a line of surface water pumps. Better tolerances, more open tolerances, probably a lot better flow. The only thing that sits in the water is a piece of inch and a half suction tube and a foot valve.
Mm-hmm.
So I have that much less stuff in the water. So if it does go dry, I'm not going to bottom a pump out in it. Mm-hmm. And it gives me that much more range to pump out. If I can be a lot more effective with the water I have. Mm-hmm. And that's been one of the innovations that I've really has changed it for me.
That's great. Are those pumps, like these new generation like that, are they self-priming then, you know?
No, you prime them once.
Okay.
You prime them once. And it's not that big of a deal, because I can tell my guys, we usually do 50 to 75 feet of inch and a half, and we'll put a cam lock on one end and a cam lock on the other. Just fill it before you leave.
Right.
Fill it at home with the hose. Good project for the kids. Get all the water in that pipe. Then a quart of water just to top everything off, and it'll go.
Yeah.
And we have sensors on it where if it ever loses its prime, it ain't gonna run.
Yeah.
So that's, the pump will save itself.
Well, and I really wanted to bring that up. I wouldn't say we're in an era of more, but it does seem like maybe there's more awareness. But, you know, blue-green algaes and surface algaes, they're always a question. And as Madison suggested, we can't do biological testing. We can do, you know, minerals and solids and suspended solids and give you an idea of what that, you know, basically it's electrical conductivity that we're really testing and how much is in the water. But the biological testing, so if you come in with a really, really dirty water source and it's full of algae, it really goes back to what Madison said earlier. It's like common sense, like, would you want to drink it, right? And once you ask that question, then it kind of opens people's eyes, like, well, you know, maybe I could do better.
And I know that there's labs. I know for sure, I believe NDSU does it. And we'll actually send, if a blue-green algae bloom was of concern, we can send up there to test. But a lot of the times, you will see that problem long before
you get a result.
Yes. And you'll kind of see these, you might not see a bloom, but you'll see that if that might be an issue that you'll come up with in your system long before a bloom might actually happen.
And you can't, and that's where the common sense is that you can validate those suspicions, but my goodness, we're, you know, you come into me and I see that. I'm like, you need to move the cattle now. We don't want you to wait for a blue-green algae bloom test to, you know, to validate your dead livestock. You know, like we need to be really proactive in that. And so how do we avoid all that? You can actually pump from some of those. I mean, now I'm not, it's all circumstantial. It's all one-off. However, pulling water from the mid to lower column mitigates a lot of those worries. And that's, and of course, then you just step up with row water or, you know, well water. And so I have a whole bunch of tidbits I'd like to kind of pick Wayne's brain about here, you know, on systems management. But I want to start with a big picture thing first, Wayne. We don't have to go real deep into this, but I'm kind of wondering where we're at in the conversation with rural water systems. Right now, we've got a lot of herds on rural water systems that really 10, 15 years ago, we didn't. And you know, these systems, I wouldn't say they're at capacity, but they're definitely rural water systems are now providing water to municipalities more than they used to. These herds, I did some math, more or less, an average size herd can use up to about 2 million gallons a year. Is 2 million gallons a lot? You know, like what is the context of moving water out of rural water systems? So, what are you starting to hear or see in the world of tapping into rural water? Is there anything that's emerging or changing, or is everybody still pretty comfortable with these herds going on rural water systems?
Rural water, from what I've seen the last, let's do a 5-year trend here. Getting a tap for anything other than domestic household use sometimes is an issue, sometimes it isn't. It depends on the area and who the provider is and what their infrastructure availability is, because they have to have a reserve. They can't tap into that. And that's kind of the starting point. A lot of it is, you know, rural water was, they may have put it in 15 years ago, but they bought more land. So, want to extend that, and that works okay as long as it's the same cattle. We're not increasing their herd, just grazing new ground, because some of them will limit you on gallons. I'd be interested to see what the comparison is between the small cattle herd and a four-person household.
Yeah, I didn't. I'm not going to say those numbers because my
I
mind's
don't
going
know. That's
fuzzy.
why I'm asking.
I did some comparisons. So, like you say, 2 million, and it sounds like a lot. It's a pittance compared to like a town. Now, whereas a dairy, let's say a 12,000 head dairy operation is going to use as much water as a 5,000 person town. In a daily average, something like that. I don't think we should draw those. I'm not comfortable putting those numbers on the table. But I think what I am trying to get at is don't assume ask, right? Do your research ahead of time to see if your rural water system will provide and has the capacity. And then the other side, other than all the nutritional stuff with rural water, is that the kind of the there's pros and cons to every decision. What you gain in the world of, say, if you're working with NRCS, for instance, and you're entering into an EQIP program or any number of programs where a water system is supported. And with those systems, they want to make sure that there's a slight overbuild and storage. The reason people really gravitate to rural water is because it kind of automatically meets your storage capacity needs. You don't have to overtank, you don't have to double your tanks because you've got a really positive, you know, reliable source. So there's a money savings there on the infrastructural investment. And I guess I just want to bring that up because it's ask first, right? Do the
Now, I
research.
always ask first. There's a lot of research to do that a producer needs to do before they settle on one thing. Reach out to NRCS, reach out to the extension office. Say, it's what I like to do. What are my options? That's a great way to start a conversation because they'll steer you in the right direction. The
Great.
great thing about the extension and the NRCS is these people like doing their job. You know, they're happy to do it. They're a great source for you. The other side of it, I mean, you talk about rural water. One great thing about rural water is consistency. You have consistent quality of water. The chemical balance is always very consistent. The pressure and flow is usually consistent. The temperature is going to be consistent. There's a lot of consistencies there, but that consistency may have an expense tied to it. That how is that going to pan out 5 years from now if the cattle market does a correction per head? When you have dams that maybe they were fenced out from the cattle. would be an alternate source of water for maybe less money. I don't know. That's what I'm asking you as a producer. You need to figure that out.
Okay.
I mean, everybody wants to expand, and rural water is consistent, and that's one of the beauties of it.
That's great.
Yeah, that's during grad school, I was a assistant manager at our cow-calf facility just right on the edge of Brookings. And I believe that we were either on city or rural water, kind of the same system. But when we were wanting to build that facility, we had to go and ask, because one of the things that we really needed if we wanted to do research was to ensure that we weren't going to be having compounding effects come in due to water quality. We needed to make sure we had highly consistent water quality for these projects to happen, without having to then potentially make those results faulty, because we couldn't confirm nor deny what the water quality was. So we talked to them, and they actually had to put, I believe, like a 6 or 8 inch main going to the main property so that we could then individually pipe off to do all of our rotational grazing paddocks. They all have Ritchie fountains. We have 8 electronic watering systems in our monoslope barn. We've got Ritchies in all of our dry lot pens. And that was a big thing to work out with them to make sure that they could provide us with enough and pressure and quality and all those things. But inadvertently, it's an expense that was worth it, not only because we have our research things going on, but just the consistency of making sure those cows were getting a consistent product coming out of those tanks was worth it on our end for that. And I think, you know, if rural water doesn't work, or it's something that you just can't, you know, stomach the bill to get them to put a bigger main to supply the amount of water that you need, that's fine. But making sure that the water that you're willing to use does have a similar consistency, and, you know, one day it's not going to produce something that's the best water you've ever seen, and then the next day it's pumping sand out of the bottom of the pond kind of thing.
Well, one of the things that I and we're going to get a little nerdy here with some water facts and figures, but it's a really important stuff for people to understand. But one of the things I did, I think I ran these numbers, I don't know, 5, 10 years ago. I don't even remember, sometime here in the last reasonable bit. So the numbers are probably still relatively accurate. I looked at the rates for, I think, 6 rural water systems. I just was curious. You take an average herd of 200 cows, whatever, you look at your rate, and I came up with an average of about 12 cents a day to water a cow-calf pair as an actual cost over summer. And I'm like, you know, who wouldn't invest 12 cents a day? That's not that bad. I mean, it's an expense, but it's only about a 5 to 10% of what we might invest in yardage fees, right? And then when you put it in that context, it's like, you know, wouldn't you, that's a state, because you just told us, you know, you get that 10% back in gain. So it I don't know. It's an interesting thing.
It's something that when you start putting your numbers together and really looking, like Wayne said, asking and doing your research and really figuring out what options you're willing to explore and the price tag you're willing to put on investing in your infrastructure that'll impact your production goals. I think that's, if you were to get anything out of this episode, I hope is the fact that you understand that it's doing your research and asking the questions and talking to people across organizations, across different companies, to just get more familiar with the pros and cons of any structure, any development, anything like that.
Cool agreement. I mean, it goes back to ask those questions. Talk to rural water. Everyone I've ever dealt with, they know their numbers. They know their availability on volume. They know the pressure on every line. All these guys you see driving around in the Webb Water pickups and the Mid-Dakota pickups, they're geniuses. They're experts on their section. They know exactly where the water's at and what's available. I mean, just, you know, call in and say, this is what I want to do. What do you have for capacity, and what's this going to cost me?
And they like sharing that knowledge too. That's their wheelhouse. They're good at it.
They're very good at it.
Okay, so I got some nerdy things, Wayne. But this is important.
Oh, I'm sure you do nerdy. You do nerdy really well.
There we go. Okay, so let's just pick your brain a little bit. Let's share things. What your thoughts on overland distances, air pre you know air expansion in lines, pressures, etc. Let's talk about, overland pipe, right? We got black pipe going over the ground, sometimes at some pretty extensive distances, and we get things like friction loss and air and all. So tell me, share with us, like, generally, bring us into Wayne's world a little bit on all that stuff on design.
If we're going to have an overland pipe line, why can't we plow it in at 2 feet?
I didn't ask you that question yet. That was the next question.
All right, so.
So let's say you got an existing system and you're happy with it and whatever, or you're thinking about building and you're not plowing in. What are some of the considerations on distance, expansion, pressures? How do you have that
Well,
conversation?
number one, you're going to have to move with a pump or gravity.
Okay.
Two, the two best friends. Friction loss, anybody can calculate that out for you. I can do it. NRCS can do it. You can do it for somebody coming in, and we'll make it work. Rule of thumb is that everybody thinks 1 inch is going to solve their problem, and 1 inch usually doesn't help a bit. We minimally will be at the inch and a quarter, the inch and a half. And if we're dealing with a gravity system, I'll use, for example, a system up in Summit that got done this year, 8,000 feet of pipe. We're pumping from a dam up top of the hill to a 3,000 gallon storage tank, gravity flowing out of that to six watering areas so we can and move those cattle where we want.
Sure.
And that was all 2 inch.
Okay.
Just 2 inch, the friction loss in 2 inch, I mean, it flows. It's low pressure, but it flows. That's the
Right.
beauty of it.
How about draining, freezing, those types of things for overland systems? Everybody's got their own theories. Let's hear what's actually truthful. Like,
What has worked for us is number one, I'm using the right pipe.
okay.
I think we've been down this road before,
We
but
have, you know.
internally size and external size controlled. The pipe that we'll use on these, we don't use any, there's no metal fittings, there's no insert. All the stuff is outside diameter controlled. It's 200 PSI pipe minimum. And we socket fusion, electronically weld our plastic fittings on. Because normally, if you think about an overland pipe, it freezes because you didn't catch it, you go on a spring. What's popped? The hose clamps, normally. So that's all of our fittings on there, and that works well. The other side of that is there's always going to be a low spot. We'll just put a little stub out drain on it. You don't have to drain the entire line. You just have to drain enough to get enough room for expansion. Because if it freezes and it's on the surface and you don't have all the water out, that will. Ice will freeze in the shape of that pipe and the diameter and move down the pipe. So you let it, you give it the room.
Yeah, that 200 PSI high density pipe. And so, correct me if I'm wrong. And I always recommend trying to drain it out. But
As much as you
I
can.
also will acknowledge that you can get away with, we know we can drive on it within reason on some, smaller equipment. We know that we can kind of let it freeze. But am I right in sharing this that when you go with low pressure pipe, like you're, I'm not picking on, let's say your big box store, low pressure black pipe, right? Ice freezes first, then expands. It doesn't do both at the same time. So
Right.
that the 200 PSI pipe will force the ice to not be able to expand in a diameter because the pipe is so strong that it has to expand lengthwise, right?
Yep.
Whereas a cheaper pipe, the ice wins,
Cheaper
more
pipe.
or less.
Cheaper pipe is going to give up the fight sooner.
Yeah.
Well, probably another example that would be, again, north of here, that system, 3,000 gallon storage. My question was, first off, a storage tank on a hill that's 8, 9 foot tall, you got to anchor and ballast it. My question to the manufacturer was, can I leave some water in here over the winter for ballast? They said, sure, leave it a third full. Well, you just have to figure out what 1,000 gallons of water weighs. Yeah, that works out really well. It's great weight. And it's just going to, because it's going to go out. I think it's a 9% increase. Or expand 9%. Does
Okay,
that sound about
I
right?
don't know for
I
sure.
think it's 9%. Don't maybe sign paperwork for it. I could be
That's
wrong.
why I called you the
Yeah. But yeah, 9% seems right in my mind. I could be wrong against it. If I am, please call in and correct me.
nerd. Now let's go to your shallow bury. Let's talk about that a little bit. What are the pros and cons in the shallow bury, especially, and does it mitigate freezing with the high, all management things still the same? This kind of address
would agree. I mean, one thing that'll dictate that is like this year, no, I wouldn't help a whole lot because we've had really cold temps and we got no snow cover.
Right.
So the frost has driven in already. If we can get snow cover before, sorry about that pounding on my hand there.
Good.
I'm trying to emphasize the point. If we can get that snowpack before, that snowpack is a great insulator. The benefits of getting that shallow burrow in, because before it was always you run surface pipe or you trench it in 6 feet. It's just like, we used to do that. And I was just like, gosh, that's expensive.
Yeah.
It's just like, we just got this thing in our mind. Well, it was just a summer pasture and we have a way to drain it. We should be able to find a zone we can get that down where it's protected, especially if there's like a grass
Right,
fire
right.
or other issues, or somebody hooks it with farm implement where we can protect this to a degree, but not have the expense of going all the way. And we found like real shallow burrow, real fiber plow it in a couple of feet, maybe 2.5 feet, depends on the ground. And that, if it freezes, it'll thaw. It's fine. If you go into that intermediate zone around that 4 foot, we found, because we did burst some pipe there once just to see it, we actually did freeze it and it took forever for it to warm up.
Oh yeah, I never thought
Because
about that.
I mean, you won't start to thaw until the frost is gone now.
Right.
Because if you think about South Dakota, frost line is 6 feet. So like when you're putting in these, not really the Ritchies, but anything you're using geothermal to help heat a tank with, you're in a 7 to 8 foot because you're tapping geothermal, you're below frost zone. So for us, we found that getting it down in that 2 foot thing gave us a temperature stability on the pipe. Because what we've seen happen is with a surface pipe, if there's a lot of elevation increases and decreases, you get entrained air in there. And you'll get what's called a fish mouth in the pipe. It'll just basically the entrained air will eat a hole in it. Because hot black pipe, cool, cold water, moving, entrained air, it's a perfect storm. What we found was plowing it in, getting it stabilized, 2 feet below the ground in that temperature zone, cooler air, the pipe doesn't get hot. It's cooler water going in your tank. That worked really well. And the expense is much lower than trying to dig it at six.
Right. I mean, I run an overland system at home. It's a small operation, and it's just enough to really annoy me that I have to deal with, and I wish I was shallow buried because I've done all of those things, hooking it, driving on it, burned. There's so that I love the idea of shallow buried, and I love the vibroplow idea because you don't disturb much.
Well, that's the thing with the vibroplow that I really like versus the trencher, because I've trenched before and you have a much smaller weed path. Normally, if you're going to trench, you've got to go on both sides and you've got to plow that back on and you've got to let that trench settle. Where a lot of times, if we just plow it, I'll just drive over the plow mark and you hardly tell it's there. I mean, it's nothing you're going to break a leg in. That's the benefit of it. But the big thing is, overland isn't bad. Overland's a good start. Because let's face it, there's some places where you can't plow. It's not rocky, it's rock. So at that point, you either have to build it up and put the pipe in, or you have to just find another way around. Maybe we just excavate a different distance. But, an overland system is great. If this is a new system we're doing, we're just trying to see what works and where we want it. Do it overland for a year or two, then you might be out there that second summer. I really wish that tank was over there because it would work a lot better. You get the cattle moved where I want them, fine. So we mark that spot out, move that tank over, we try it out. Hey, yeah, this is what I really had in mind. Then we can go back in and plow it, and you might be in a few fittings, but we'll be able to use your pipe again. But the big thing for protecting the pipe was I had a client. I didn't do his system. He was running off rural water, so that cold, cold water overland. Up and down, he was getting a ton of fish mouths. So we went in and we ended up taking all his old pipe, cutting the bad spots out, and holding good spots back in and plowing the whole thing in for him. It was in a quarter. And it's worked much better.
I love this. I love this.
And it also extends your grazing season.
Right.
I mean, you aren't going to get, down into that at 2 foot for quite a while.
Right. That's a good point. And the welded pipe options, the fittings options are still great. They work really, really well. The welded options are better. I think we can say that. There's a mixing and matching that goes on there. You can be really innovative. I know people that rent, they go down to their local rental store and get a big air compressor with good storage, and then you isolate sections of the system. You can build up an adapter in minutes to hook up to a compressor to your piping because of the outside fittings. and blow the systems out. You know, there's just so many innovative, easy things as long as you kind of pre-think. So my question then to you, what's the most fun or interesting or innovative project you think you've worked on? Or is that putting you on the spot?
There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times the more difficult it is to do, as you're doing it, you're like, oh man, I should have finished college. I should have been an investment banker because this ain't a lot of fun. But then when you get it done and you see that water getting where it needs to go and you see it making a difference for your customer at that point, you're like, yeah, that was fun. That was worth it.
Yeah.
You know, you're cold in November doing it, but then in December when you're sitting in the warm office going back through it, going, yeah, that wasn't so bad.
Yeah. Well, I love what I think you've brought to our knowledge of the area is being able to value, let's say, value add an investment. So, you know, once you design a system, and then what I appreciate about Wayne is like, okay, maybe for a little more money, we can put this pump. You're buying a pump. We're not going to buy 10 of them. We're going to buy one or two, and we're going to put them on trailers. And we're going to move that resource around, and we're going to make this system work for you 300 days out of the year versus 30 days, depending on your rotations. And these are just investment strategies that I think really make sense. So.
I guess as we near the end of our conversation, at least today, are there any kind of closing thoughts, arguments, things that maybe as we've been talking, you've thought about that you kind of want to be that last send home message before we sign off?
I'll go seek out your resources. I mean, I know I've said it before. The Extension Office, NRCS, they're great resources. They're well educated and they've all got field experience. They'll tell you what's going to work and not work. They give you a baseline. It's your idea. It's that spark in your mind of what you want to do. They'll take start taking helping you down that path of saying, this will work better than this will work. Or maybe this will work really well and that won't work so well. They have that knowledge and it's a resource. And like I said, they like doing their job. There's nobody in NRCS who's doing field work who doesn't like it. Because if they did, you wouldn't be doing it.
I would say my rule of thumb, Wayne's hit it on the head, but to take it one step further, a lot of people that are exploring water, or maybe they're new to the land, they're new to that pasture, they're new. I think people need to slow down a little bit. I really like to see people manage their property for 2 years before I will suggest that they really get into now a new design. They'll learn what their livestock, how their system works, because it's so tempting to jump into, say, a cost share program. And then you look over your shoulder and you're like, gosh, I wish we would have just done this a little different or that a little different, because they hadn't had enough time to learn the nuances of their system, their movements. You know, maybe their gates are in the wrong spot. You know, and so I just really want people to slow down, really learn their system first, think about it strategically, because I guarantee every time you sit on a hill and think, you're like, oh gosh, I never thought about doing it this way. And maybe if you're in a program, it becomes kind of too late to change because of the, you know, and we have to realize that program dollars are partner dollars. And so you're entering into a partnership. And those are contracts and there's rules. And so sometimes common sense after the fact is too late. And so I just really want people to seek out their resources, like Wayne said, slow down, build a team. And a few minds is going to get you further faster than maybe what you're going to come up in your own with in, on your own. So, very similar. So.
I want to thank the both of you for joining me on this podcast. This realm of conversations is something that I am still learning a lot about. Just growing up in a very traditional cow-calf system, kind of realizing that there's different ways to do things that we've always done, and you don't have to do it that way just because that's how the people before you did it. There's a reason why people like Wayne have a job. There's a reason why me and Pete work in extension to bring these resources to people. So yeah, I definitely want to thank you both for joining me. I've had a fun time learning and exploring the options available, not only in alternative watering systems, but all of the little, sidetracks that we went down in this conversation. It's been interesting to hear how these systems are also being used in practice, and Wayne, how you've been working with producers to make these systems work in their operations. I hope our listeners will take advantage of the information you have both shared with us on their operations and really start to think about the why. why they do the things that they do. With that, this has been Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef cattle. Visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information. Until next episode, stay curious and keep learning.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. We invite you to visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information, as well as subscribe to the show on Spotify. You will also find show notes and resources from today's episode. Until next time, remember, success is not a goal, it's a byproduct.